Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1133, The Plot to Kill King. This is being recorded on June 8th of the year 2020. I am interrupting the long and ongoing series covering various aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic / crisis, and I'm going to do a program which is my reaction to the killing of George Floyd and the aftermath of that event, and in particular to the journalistic coverage of same, and really to the political and psychosocial reaction of people in this society to that event. Now, as you listen to what I have to say, you should bear in mind that I'm coming down the home stretch of my 41st year on the air, and I have been covering American political events, and in particular, the history of fascism in this country and around the world, dating back to the lead-up to World War II for decades. I've done it many programs about things that impact the African-American community, and I was struck a little over 2 years ago, on April 4th of 2018, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. I did a 12-hour program on sister station KFJC-FM about Dr. King's murder, beginning with AFA program number 8, recorded on April 4th of 1985, the 17th anniversary of Dr. King's murder, and added to many times over the years, and then following that up with For the Record program number 46, which was recorded in 1995, 10 years after Dr. King's, or after the original recording of AFA number 8 on the 17th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. Then on April 3rd, the evening before that, I recorded 2 more hours that I presented and that are in the archives on the SpitfireList.com website as addenda to For the Record 46. I was struck at the time, again, a little over 2 years ago, at the complete absence, or almost total absence, of substantive discussion about Dr. King's assassination and the information that has been brought to light in the decades since his killing. A number of authors have done a very heroic job of investigating Dr. King's assassination. By far and away the most exhaustive and heroic are the 3 books about Dr. King's assassination authored by Dr. William F. Pepper, a close personal associate of Dr. King's. In 1995, he published the book Orders to Kill about Dr. King's assassination, and we accessed information from that book at great length in the aforementioned For the Record number 46. Then Pepper published a follow-up volume, Act of State, and then in 2016 in hardcover, and in 2018, in softcover, Dr. Pepper published the book, The Plot to Kill King, and we are going to be using that book for our coverage this evening. And again, it struck me as amazing in 2018 that for all of the coverage of Dr. King on the 50th anniversary of his killing, there was an almost total absence of discussion of the actual circumstances surrounding his killing. For those people who are young, the killing was officially performed by a fellow named James Earl Ray, another of the proverbial lone nuts, who supposedly killed King because he was a racist. And in fact, James Earl Ray was not a racist, and it has now been proved that he was a patsy. The circumstances surrounding Dr. King's assassination are very well known at this point in time. In For the Record 46, and recorded in 1995, and added to again the evening before the 50th anniversary, we covered the striking information about the 20th Special Forces Group A-Team, a 184th A-Team, a group of highly trained Vietnam veterans who were a backup sniper team to the civilian sniper who actually took Dr. King's life in 1995. We opined from Dr. Pepper's book, Orders to Kill, that that was a Raoul, who was a fellow who was certainly involved in the assassination. He appears to have been one of James Earl Ray's handlers. There are evidentiary tributaries running between Raoul and the milieu of the JFK assassination and Jack Ruby in Dallas, Texas. We are not going to reprise that information with the exception of touching briefly on some of the information presented by a member of that Special Forces team. They came forward when it became clear to them that what was known as a cleanup operation was going on. Members of the team were being assassinated themselves in order to cover up the operation. A couple of them fled to Mexico, and eventually four members of the team, under the pseudonyms presented by Dr. Pepper of Warren, Murphy, Reynolds, and Norton, gave an altogether compelling and very chilling account of their activities. One of them, who was an experienced combat photographer and was apparently there to take pictures of potential witnesses who then would be eliminated themselves, instinctively swung his camera to the bushes where the sniper had, from where the bushes, the sniper had fired, and took pictures of the sniper, and it was not James Earl Ray. I was struck again by the total absence of coverage of the actual circumstances about Dr. King's killing. Once again, when I observed the orgiastic coverage of George Floyd's death and the aftermath, I also noted some evidentiary tributaries running between some of the people who gathered, I guess one could say, in the aftermath of Floyd's killing, and not only the assassination of Martin Luther King, but also the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Shortly after Dr. Floyd was killed, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who delivered a eulogy at a memorial service for George Floyd, decamped for Minneapolis. It is well known that Al Sharpton is an informant for the FBI. He was also alleged in the San Francisco Examiner by the late Warren Hinkle to have worked for the CIA, I should say, in Grenada. In addition to Al Sharpton, the Reverend Jesse Jackson decamped for Minneapolis, and as discussed in For the Record 46 and in For the Record 1005, according to a sworn deposition by Ronald Adkins, a fellow whom we will talk about extensively in this program. Jesse Jackson was himself a paid operative of the FBI and was given money to do two things in connection with Dr. King's assassination. One of those was to help arrange for Dr. King to stay in room 306 of the Lorraine Motel, which was an elevated room above the pool, which gave the sniper a clear shot instead of the sheltered ground floor room 202. And according to Ron Adkins, Jesse Jackson was also charged with getting the Invaders, that was a group of Black Power militants in Memphis at the time, who were functioning as sort of a security detail for Dr. King and who were there to help ensure that the march Dr. King was going to engage in on behalf of striking Memphis City sanitation workers would be peaceful. Their departure was arranged by Jesse Jackson about 20 minutes before King was killed. And they showed up in both, that is to say, Sharpton and Jackson showed up in Minneapolis, and then a second autopsy of George Floyd was performed by Dr. Michael Badden, a former chief medical examiner for New York City. Dr. Michael Badden had given testimony before the House Select Committee on Assassinations that reinforced the untenable single bullet or magic bullet theory, as it is known. So this was a familiar cast of characters. I would also note that Keith Ellison, the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, who will be presiding over the trials of the officers who have been charged in connection with George Floyd's assassination, has one foot in the Nation of Islam and another in the Muslim Brotherhood. So it will be interesting to see how that goes. I was, again, just stunned by the exhaustive coverage of Dr. Floyd's death and the almost total absence of substantive coverage of the actual events that led to Dr. King's death in 1968 on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's killing. And in this program, I'm going to present some more of the actual circumstances surrounding Dr. King's assassination. We will touch briefly on the 20th Special Forces Group backup team, but mostly we will be focusing on other aspects of the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King. In particular, we will be looking at machinations that were performed by the Memphis political machine of a guy named Russell Adkins Sr. Russell Adkins Sr. Wore many different overlapping political hats, to use a metaphor. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He also was a member of the Dixie Mafia. That was a powerful Southern, is a powerful Southern organized crime syndicate that is distinct from the actual mafia in the Southern states. It should be noted that the Dixie Mafia did, in fact, work with mafiosi from the southern states, people like Carlos Marcello, the capo mafioso of New Orleans, and Frank Liberto, both now deceased, and others. But the Dixie Mafia is distinct from the actual mafia, with a capital M, in the southern states, but it again, does work with it. The Dixie Mafia machine in Memphis, Tennessee, of Russell Adkins Sr., also worked closely with the Masons in that area. Now, there are any number of high-blown internet conspiracy theories about Freemasonry and the Masons, and I don't want to be misunderstood in any way as playing into those. But there are certain networks. The Masons were actually targeted for extermination by the Third Reich, and then after they were finished off, so to speak, there were going to be museums that were going to be dedicated to both the Jews and the Masons. So again, what I'm about to talk about is not to be misunderstood as actually playing into those conspiracy theories, but there are certain networks within Freemasonry which, because of the closed slash covert nature of the organization and its meetings, have been used as operational networks for various kinds of dark political activities. Perhaps the best known to regular listeners to this program is the P2 Lodge in Italy and Latin America of Licio Gelli. In For the Record 691, we spoke about the Confederate Secret Service and their authorship of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. The Confederate Secret Service used certain Freemason cells as vehicles for some of their sub rosa activities. And a prominent member of the Ku Klux Klan, according to a number of sources, General Albert Pike, a Confederate general, was actually a prominent member of the Masons and designed some of the rites for Scottish Freemasonry. So again, Russell Adkins' role with the Masons as well as the Klan is important. This should not be misunderstood as playing into some of these anti-Masonic or anti-Mason internet conspiracy theories. As we will see, the political machine of Russell Adkins Sr., taken over by his son Russell Jr. for the assassination, wielded a profound influence not only in Memphis politics, but was a major factor, perhaps the most important local executive element in the assassination to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. They wielded a profound influence on the Memphis city government, having elevated then Memphis Mayor Henry Loeb, and also apparently a fellow named Frank Holloman, who was the commissioner for the Memphis Police and Fire Departments. And both of them will figure into our narrative here. It was according to Ron Adkins that his father got money from the number two man in the FBI, Clyde Tolson, who, in addition to being J. Edgar Hoover's top lieutenant, was also J. Edgar Hoover's live-in lover for many years as well. Hoover lived with his mother till he was 43, then eventually took up residence with Clyde Tolson, the number two man at the in the FBI at that time, and Hoover's lover. According to Ron Adkins, Clyde Tolson passed money to his father to be given to, among others, Jesse Jackson and also the Reverend Billy Kiles, whose role in the assassination we will discuss here in a minute. Before getting to the role of the Adkins political machine, again, one part Mason, one part Ku Klux Klan, and also liaising with the FBI as well as being part of the Dixie Mafia and liaising with the Southern Italian Mafia, we want to note here that the Russell Adkins machine was central to what was going on in Memphis, and yet it also was functioning as a proxy or as a local element for the national conspiracy to murder Martin Luther King. The significance of the assassination of Martin Luther King, as well as other assassinations, and I'm going to touch on the assassination of Robert Kennedy later, or an evidentiary tributary running between the assassination of Martin Luther King and that of Robert Kennedy, which took place 2 months later. We are going to be relying for our information on the third of Dr. William F. Pepper's books, The Plot to Kill King, subtitled The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., published in soft cover by Sky Horus Publishing. And in the introduction, the preface to The Plot to Kill King, William Pepper discusses the significance of the assassination. When one is confronted with the assassination of a major leader who personifies the most treasured values of the species, and it becomes clear that those responsible for the murder are officials of his own government, acting with the sanction of those in the shadows who actually rule, surely one should strive to understand what that means now and for the future. In other words, when the removal of a leader who has offended powerful forces and special interests in the Republic takes on the status of an act of state, citizens must contemplate what this reveals about their culture and its civil and political systems, their freedom, the quality and status of the rule of law, and their entire way of life. Indeed, again, I was struck by the contrast between the orgiastic coverage of George Floyd's killing and its aftermath, and the almost total absence of substantive discussion of Dr. King's assassination, or the actual circumstances on the 50th anniversary of that event. Now, again, we are going to talk about the political machine in Memphis, Tennessee, of Russell Lee Adkins. That's Russ Sr. He died in 1967, and his son, Russell Jr., took over management of the Memphis role of the assassination plot. Note here the role of the Ku Klux Klan and the Masons and the Dixie Mafia in anointing the governing figures in Memphis, Tennessee. Note that Ron Adkins, the son of Russell Lee Adkins, Russell Sr., alleges that his father took him to his first Ku Klux Klan lynching when he was just 6 years old. Note also, Dr. Green Bland, he was the Adkins personal family physician. He will figure prominently as well. He was the chief of surgery at St. Joseph's Hospital, to which Dr. King was taken, and we'll see what happened there. And again, the role of the Adkins political machine in what took place at St. Joseph's Hospital. Of the Adkins political machine, and this is from a sworn deposition by Ron Adkins. He, Ron Adkins, son of Russell Lee Adkins, said his father and associates were lifelong active Klan members and Masons. He sat in on meetings and recalled that his father said they would only have doctors who were Catholics because they would never tell about what was going on. It is for this reason that he only remembers Drs. Breen and Basil Bland taking care of their family, especially Breen, B-R-E-E-N, who was closest to them. His father became a 32nd degree Mason. The Klan and the Masons worked closely together. Ron said that his father took him to his first Klan lynching when he was just 6 years old. His father and grandfather got along well with boss E. H. Crump, who ran Memphis. From the age of 5 until he was 9 years old, his father took him along to meetings in the house and elsewhere. Ron would end up bringing coffee and donuts and sit around listening. He remembers John Wilder, before he became Lieutenant Governor of Tennessee, attending those meetings along with Mayor Henry Loeb of Memphis and Frank Liberto, Carlos Marcello, and Clyde Tolson, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's deputy. Despite his father's modest position, he had an enormous ability to get things done behind the scenes. He was a, quote, fixer, unquote. This power clearly emanated from his positions in the Masons, the Klan, and the Dixie Mafia. According to Ronnie, the Klan and the Masons had different styles. The Klansmen were the heavies, and the Masons were more subtle. Together, they put Mayor Henry Loeb into office in Memphis, Tennessee. What we're going to talk about next is the role of Russell Lee Adkins acting as a conduit for money that was given to him by the number two man in the FBI, Clyde Tolson, in order to bribe the warden of the Missouri State Prison, a fellow named Harold Swenson, to arrange for the, quote, escape, unquote, of James Earl Ray, who had already been profiled as a patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King. This is discussed by William Pepper in The Plot to Kill King. FBI official Clyde Tolson was a substantial connection for his, Ronnie Adkins, father. Of particular interest to this case is that he brought the money which was to be paid to Harold Swenson, the warden of the Missouri State Prison in Jefferson City, Missouri, in order for him to arrange for the escape of James Earl Ray in 1967. At J. Edgar Hoover's request, James had been profiled as a potential scapegoat, although the nature of the crime was not revealed. Ron told us about this assignment because he was an actual observer to the event. He saw the money being delivered by Tolson, and then, at his father's invitation, he rode to the prison where money was paid to Swenson by his father. This took place in November or December of 1966. Ray, who was always kept in the dark about this arrangement, successfully escaped from prison on April 23, 1967, and then, with the wrong fingerprints being released to the public, was monitored, controlled, given the protected Eric Stavro Galt identity, and moved around until the plans for the assassination and his use were finalized. I came to understand that this use of inmates was not an uncommon practice. And in addition to acting as the vehicle for Clyde Tolson and J. Edgar Hoover to bribe Harold Swenson, the warden of the Missouri State Prison at Jefferson City, to arrange for the escape of James Earl Ray so that he would serve as the patsy for the Martin Luther King assassination. The Adkins machine also arranged for two Memphis sanitation workers to be killed in a malfunctioning garbage truck accident. This was to generate outrage, which in turn was to help propel the strike by the Memphis sanitation workers, and that was done in order to compel Dr. King to return to Memphis in order to support the striking sanitation workers, and that was to get him there in order to murder him. Turning again to the plot to kill King. In early 1968, two workers, 35-year-old Ecole Cole, that's E-C-H-O-L-E, Cole, and 29-year-old Robert Walker, were literally swallowed by a malfunctioning, quote, garbage packer, unquote, truck. We would later learn that this was a planned murder by the Dixie Mafia family of Russell Adkins in coordination with Memphis Police Department Director of Police and Fire Frank Holloman, H-O-L-L-O-M-A-N, in order to compel Dr. King to return to Memphis in order to support the striking sanitation workers. And what we're going to talk about next is the deposition of Lenny Curtis. He was a custodian for the Memphis Police Department and observed a number of things, including, according to Lenny Curtis, a Memphis policeman and Vietnam veteran named Frank Strausser, S-T-R-A-U-S-S-E-R, who, according to Lenny Curtis, was actually selected in order to be the actual sniper to kill Martin Luther King. And Glennie Curtis deposed under oath to this effect and discussed the training, or the practice, I should say, that Frank Strausser engaged in with this particular rifle at the shooting range of the Memphis Police Department. And he was there with Memphis Police Department Captain Earl Clark of Glennie Curtis, and his testimony, or his deposition, I should say, about the allegations concerning Frank Strausser. Going back to the firing range on the day of the killing, Lamy described the rifle as being brand new. He said it was, quote, a strange-looking rifle, but it made a tremendous noise every time he, Strausser, was shooting down there. He spent time with it all the day, quote. On that day, he broke to take lunch with Memphis Police Department Captain Earl Clark, and when he returned, he resumed firing. When he left at around 3:30 p.m., he put down the top on the convertible, took off his powder blue shirt, and threw it over the rifle, which was in the back seat, leaving only his white T-shirt on. He then ruffled his hair and put on a pair of sunglasses. When he left, Memphis Mayor Henry Loeb, Memphis Chief of Police and Fire Frank Holloman, and the other visiting police officers were still there. They had met in Lieutenant Bullard's office, B-U-L-L-A-R-D. Now, what we're going to do next is to present a synopsis of the course of events on April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, note again the presence at key places of Mayor Henry Loeb and Director Frank Holloman. Note the executive influence of the Russell Adkins Dixie Mafia slash Klan slash Mason political machine in Memphis and its local executive function as a coordinating element of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Note also one of the things we spoke about in some of the addenda to For the Record Program number 46, which we came back to in For the Record Program number 1005, about Clyde Polson having given money to Russell Adkins Sr. in order to be dispensed to not only Jesse Jackson, but also to the Reverend Billy Kiles. Jesse Jackson, again, according to Ron Adkins, was tasked with helping to get Martin Luther King into room 306, the upper floor room overlooking the pool, where he was basically a very clear target, as opposed to room 202, which was a ground floor sheltered room. Also, Jesse Jackson was tasked with getting the invaders out of the Lorraine Motel so that they would not be in the position to observe and or perform any unwelcome and inconvenient actions. And Billy Kiles, according to Ron Adkins, was tasked with getting Martin Luther King out onto the balcony where he could be shot. And the events here are described by Dr. William Pepper as follows. When Dr. King returned to Memphis, he went straight to the Lorraine Motel. He had never stayed there overnight before, preferring to stay in other previously all-white hotels, although he had held meetings with local community leaders during the day at the Lorraine. When they arrived, he and Ralph Abernathy were given room 306, although they were originally to have occupied room 202, a ground floor sheltered room. Jesse Jackson was tasked with getting Walter and Lurlie Bailey to move into the upper exposed room. The evidence from Ron Tyler Adkins indicates that he did so. Despite Ralph Abernathy's insistence that room 306 was their usual room, and indeed, that they had been forced to wait for it to be vacated upon their arrival. It had never been their room before, not even for the daytime meetings, and certainly not for overnight stays. Furthermore, room 306 was vacant and unoccupied when they arrived, so they were able to go directly to it. Russell Adkins Sr. died in July of 1967, and his son Russell Jr. took over the assassination project. In fact, I have since come to believe that Frank Holloman himself arranged and facilitated the final details. Holloman regularly attended the Adkins meetings, coming out every Sunday, and organized the withdrawal of the two black firemen from the fire station and the removal of black community relations officer Ed Rebbit, R-E-W-I-T-T, from his post. He also had removed the usual group of black police officers who always provided security for Dr. King in Memphis. They were replaced by a group of white officers who were not trusted and so remained out of the picture. The Reverend Billy Kiles, at whose home the SCLC group was to have had a barbecue that evening, appears to have been given the responsibility for getting Dr. King out onto the balcony. The Memphis Police Department report by Willie B. Richmond states that, contrary to Kyle's longtime assertions, he knocked on the door at 5:50 p.m., spoke for a few seconds, and then walked down the balcony, standing at the railing about 40 to 50 feet away until the shooting. The Reverend Jesse Jackson organized the withdrawal of the invaders from the motel around 20 minutes before the killing, where they had been working with Dr. King to bring about a peaceful march. As noted elsewhere, the shooter, Frank Strausser, was observed receiving a, quote, special, unquote, rifle at the MPD shooting range the day before the killing, and then breaking it in by practice firing it most of that day and the next, taking a lunch break with Captain Earl Clark on April 4th, before leaving in the red and white Chevrolet convertible of his fireman friend. Before leaving, Strausser put the rifle in the back seat and took off his shirt, wearing only an undershirt and ruffling up his hair so that he would look more like an off-duty fireman than a police officer, and sped off. Also observed at the Memphis Police Department firing range building where he met with the shooter and Earl Clark were Director Frank Holloman and Mayor Henry Lowe, again, both of them intimates of the Adkins Dixie Mafia slash Klan slash Mason machine. Now, after Dr. King was shot and apparently gravely wounded but still alive, he was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital. And the significance of that is discussed by William Pepper as follows. Ron Adkins Tyler, under oath, told me that Dr. Breen Bland, that's capital B-R-E-E-N, Bland, B-L-A-N-D, who, remember, was also the Adkins family doctor, was in fact the head surgeon at the hospital. His medical office was about 50 yards from the hospital. He said he was present and overheard conversations between his father and Dr. Bland, and then following his father's death between his brother, Russell Jr., police and fire director Frank Holloman, and Dr. Bland about the importance of Dr. King being taken to St. Joseph's Hospital if he was still alive after having been shot. Ron recalls that Dr. Bland was prepared to give him a certain lethal injection to kill him if it became necessary. He said that the last conversation took place around the middle of March of 1968, just weeks before the assassination. From what Jonathan Shelby recalls his mother saying, the removal of the breathing tube and the use of the pillow replaced the fateful injection. Ron Atkins Tyler has no doubt that they were determined to make certain that Dr. King would never leave the emergency room at St. Joseph's Hospital alive. Though he did not know the details of the final cause of death, it appears that he was correct. And we'll hear about John Shelby. He passed along what his mother, Lula May Shelby, a surgical assistant at the hospital, had to say about Dr. King's final moments. Again, in For the Record 46, we spoke about the Special Forces A-Team, taken from the 20th Special Forces Group, that was acting as a backup unit to the civilian sniper, alleged here to be Frank Strausser. And we're not going to dwell on that, although we will come back to that briefly before the program is over. I do want people to notice, though, the formidable presence of apparent military intelligence officers at the St. Joseph's Hospital and their behavior in connection with the events we are about to discuss. From The Plot to Kill King by William Pepper. With all these events going on in close proximity, the ambulance carrying the wounded Dr. King, Dr. Abernathy, and Bernard Lee set out for St. Joseph's Hospital at approximately 6:10 p.m. Some 5 minutes later, it arrived at the hospital and Dr. King, still breathing and alive, was carried into the emergency room just after 6:15 p.m., where one would expect that work would begin in a frantic effort to save his life. What has never been satisfactorily explained, or perhaps even revealed until now, was the large presence of military intelligence officers who had taken up positions in the hospital well before the shot was fired. According to Dr. Causeway, who was on duty at the time, the military intelligence officers knew the names of all of the emergency room nurses and doctors who were on duty at the time. Dr. Causeway also observed that no consideration was being given to moving the critically injured Dr. King to the operating room, and he saw no surgical effort being made to save him. When he inquired about treatment, he was told that King was being treated. Another person on duty in the emergency room that evening was 32-year-old surgical aide Lula May Shelby, S-A-T-L-B-Y, who had worked at St. Joseph's Hospital since 1964 or 1965. Her son, Jonathan Shelby, told me and subsequently confirmed under oath that she was not allowed to go home that evening or even call home. In 2013, Jonathan Shelby called Memphis radio station WPLX, hosted by Thaddeus Matthews, to tell his mother's story. My longtime Memphis street friend, Jackie Smith, called me and facilitated my contact with him, with Jonathan. Jonathan said when his mother arrived home the next morning, April 5th, just before 11 a.m., she gathered the family in the living room to tell them what had happened. She was devastated and very hurt. He remembered clearly that she said, "I can't believe they took his life." At first glance, what a strange statement. She recalled that there were many Memphis Police Department officers and Army people milling about, in addition to some men in suits. She said she was bringing medical instruments in and out of the emergency room, which was her job, where Dr. King was lying on a bloody gurney. One more time. She said that she was bringing medical instruments in and out of the emergency room, which was her job, where Dr. King was lying on a bloodied gurney. She saw the huge hole in the lower part of his face, but heard one of the ER doctors say that he still had a pulse. The ER doctors had performed a tracheotomy and inserted a breathing tube. She said, Matt, in a while, the head of surgery, who appears to have been Dr. Green Bland, the Atkins family doctor and collaborator discussed earlier, came into the emergency room with a couple of men in suits and shouted at the staff working on Dr. King, quote, stop working on the nigger and let him die. Now, all of you, get out of here right now. Everybody, get out, unquote. Joplin said his mother told him as she was leaving, she heard three sounds of the men gathering or sucking up saliva in their mouths, and then she heard two or three spitting sounds. This caused her, on the way out, to glance back over her shoulder and see that the breathing tube had been removed and Dr. Bland put a pillow on and over the face of Dr. King. She said that she believed that he was still alive, however barely. Without a doubt, if he was still alive as he appeared to be, he would have been suffocated. Joplin Shelby repeated his full recollection of his mother's heartfelt disclosures under oath in the deposition I took of him in July of 2014. And next, we're going to go to back to the aforementioned Memphis Police Department custodian Lenny Curtis and his experiences after the assassination. He heard rumors that Frank Strausser had been the actual rifleman who killed Dr. King. And there was a good deal of discussion about Frank Strausser's apparent civil rights complaint and how he was alleged to be a target for dismissal or exiting from the Memphis Police Department. But his response to that was, less than enthusiastic. From the plot to kill King. After the assassination, he, Lenny Curtis, heard rumors from the various Memphis Police Department officers with whom he was friendly that this officer was the rifleman who killed Dr. King. Curtis said he was told after the assassination that the officer was asked to leave the Memphis Police Department, and he refused to quit. It appeared that they wanted him to go because he was increasingly disobedient and a potential embarrassment with a growing number of civil rights complaints being lodged against him. The officer reportedly told the director he would, quote, blow his A-blank-blank off. He'd shoot every one of them up there, unquote. Then Lenny Curtis describes what happened still further after the assassination. He met up with Frank Strausser, who then took him on a drive. And while driving Lenny Curtis in his car, he took something of a detour, which was not the most direct way into town, and he praised Lenny about some work that he was doing. Lenny was doing some work on the side in connection with some agents from the FBI. He was helping to distribute wanted posters and actually participated in an arrest at one point. This did not sit well with Frank Strausser, and he apparently warned Lenny in connection with his ongoing work with the FBI. And then after that, Lenny had some harrowing experiences he says that strange things were happening to him. One time, he had lit a cigarette. He opened the door to his apartment and smelled gas and quickly put out the cigarette. Occasionally, there was a strange car, a Lincoln, parked across the street from his apartment house, and he was frightened. One time when the car was there, he got into his own car and drove off. The car then followed him, and he saw who was driving it, and it was the aforementioned Frank Strausser. And then when new evidence came up, more strange things began to happen to him. He moved to a new house without notice, but the landlord said that there was a strange man hanging around in the back of the house. And when Lemmy went out and checked the area, he found a V-shaped stand on which to rest a rifle. Putting a stick in it, he found that the stick pointed directly at his kitchen and bathroom windows. This is discussed by William Pepper in The Plot to Kill King as follows. Of the drive that Frank Strasser took with Lenny Curtis and the warning he delivered, they made small talk, but when they got to Poplar and North Parkway, instead of staying on Poplar and going straight into town, which would have been the most direct route, Strasser slowed down and said, "Lenny, I want to ask you a question. What do you think about that guy Ray killing King?" Unquote. Lenny said, "Oh, he did it. There is no doubt that he did it," unquote. Then Strasser asked him, "Are you still doing private detective work? Still working with those FBIs?" Unquote. Lenny was doing part-time work for a private detective agency. He had a job doing security work, and occasionally some FBI agents would bring wanted posters to him. He actually helped them arrest one guy whom he recognized. He would also help by distributing them to stores around his community, and a number of others were caught as well. Strasser seemed to know about Lenny's sideline. The last thing he said to him was, quote, "Are you still helping the FBI?" unquote. Lenny said, "Yeah, periodically," unquote. Strasser then said, "Lenny, you be careful now," unquote. The look he gave him was clearly threatening. Lenny said that he subsequently became aware that strange things were happening to him. His gas was strangely turned on once when he was about to enter his house. He had lit a cigarette, but as he opened the door, he smelled gas and quickly put out the cigarette. A strange Lincoln was occasionally parked across the street from his apartment house. He was frightened. One morning when the car was there, he got into his own car and quickly drove off, and the strange car pulled out and followed him. He managed to see the driver. It was Frank Strasser. At that time, new evidence in the case came up. He said that every time new evidence arose, the same officer would pop up. Lenny tried to move to a new house without notice, but the landlord of the new complex would report seeing a strange man in the back of his house. When Lemmy checked the area, he found a tree stand, a V-shaped stand where you could rest a rifle. When he put a stick in it, it focused on his kitchen and bathroom windows. He moved again without notice. And eventually Lenny Curtis died. And I will note how William Pepper found inspiration in Lenny Curtis's situation and behavior. Again, Lenny Curtis was a custodian for the Memphis Police Department. Pepper writes, "The courage of this humble, working-class human stalwart has both inspired and compelled me. Now, 11 years later, in 2014, to press on in honor of the enduring vitality of the human spirit and its quest for truth. Once again, we are humbled by the nobility of one who materially is among the least of us, but whose reigning presence and values, in spite of who we are, remind us of who we could become. Lenny Curtis died in November of 2013. I safeguarded his information and his deposition for all of these years, fearful that the assassin's masters would kill him if they learned about his cooperation with me. Now that Lenny is beyond their reach, there is no reason why all that he has given up cannot now be shared. As noted above, his complete deposition may be seen in Appendix F." And we're going to go to return to the book Orders to Kill and some information we presented in For the Record 46. And this concerns the Special Forces group member who's had the pseudonym Warren. This is the Special Forces group that was the backup to the civilian sniper. And they discussed a reconnaissance mission that they were on when they were assigned to Los Angeles to scope out elements of the black militant community there. In Orders to Kill, William Pepper writes, Warren said that on that occasion in L.A., they also had a secondary mission, which was to do reconnaissance of a home up in the Western Hills near the UCLA campus. The recon was to determine the feasibility of a wet insert ops determined operation. Wet insert ops determined means that the unit carries out a surreptitious entry at night into the targeted residence, kills everyone there, and leaves without a trace. He said that their recon determined the feasibility of such an operation. Warren subsequently learned that the house was used by Senator Robert F. Kennedy when he was in Los Angeles in 1967 and 1968. Shortly after the recon, Kennedy would declare for the presidency. And of course, Robert Kennedy was killed 2 months after Martin Luther King in June of 1968. And we're going to wrap up with a discussion of a conversation that took place in the late 70s between former Representative Walter Fauntleroy of the District of Columbia, a founder of the Congressional Black Caucus, and then Speaker of the House, Carl Albert. And this was as the House Select Committee on Assassinations was being formed, and Walter Fauntleroy opined that he wanted to lead that committee. Fauntleroy informed Carl Albert, then Speaker of the House of Representatives, that he wanted to be on the committee to investigate Dr. King's death, or even, if possible, to head the committee. Albert said to him, Walter, you don't want that job. To which Fauntleroy replied, but I do want it. Why not? Albert whispered, Walter, they will kill you. Unquote. And again, presenting this information because this is really how my reaction was to the aftermath. The George Floyd's killing and the aftermath. Not that the killing wasn't terrible, but the orgiastic coverage of that and the complete absence of substantive discussion of the by now quite well-researched facts concerning Dr. King's assassination is striking. It would appear to some people that Black Lives Matter, but not past the point, Dr. King's. This concludes For the Record program number 1133, The Plot to Kill King, being recorded on June 8th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.